University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Norman Krivosha, former Chief Justice of the State of Nebraska, and his lecture titled, "The Popular Dissatisfaction with the Judicial System Revisited." Krivosha's lecture will examine whether public dissatisfaction with the judicial system is new, why it exists, and what effect it has if its purpose is not understood. Krivosha served as Chief Justice from 1978 to 1987 and is currently Executive Vice President, Secretary, and Corporate General Counsel for Emeritas Life Insurance Corporation in Lincoln. He received his B.S. from the University of Nebraska and J.D. from the University of Nebraska College of Law. Krivosha has been a member or served on the board of numerous community and professional organizations, including service on the Nebraska Wesleyan Board of Governors since 1982. Join us now for Norman Krivosha and the Nebraska Wesleyan University Forum.
Thank you, John. Thank you all very much. It's always a great pleasure for me to be on the Wesleyan campus of all of the many things that I have done. Being on the Board of Governors and working with the university has been one of the most pleasant. Don't panic at the fact that I'm taking my watch off. I am mindful of the time, and I do know when my presentation ends. You need worry only when I take out my calendar. John, I the introduction was wonderful and most appropriate. I'm most grateful to you. John and I are old friends. You probably don't realize what a fine introduction that really was. Introductions are not easy to do, and you can either make them too brief, too long. Matter of fact, I've had an experience in myself that I'd share with you about that. When I was on the court, I had been invited by a group to speak, and the individual, the master of ceremonies who was appointed to introduce me, had never in his life before ever introduced anyone else and was just absolutely panic-stricken at the thought of it. He remembered that he had a friend who was a Toastmaster, and everybody knows that Toastmasters know everything about introductions. So he went to his friend and said, "What in the world do I do about introducing the Chief Justice?" And his friend said, "Look, it's very simple. There are rules. If the speaker that you are to introduce is well known, you need not say a great deal." He said, "After all, keep in mind, when they introduce the President of the United States, have you ever heard anybody in introducing the President say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker was born in Hope, Arkansas, attended Yale University and was a Rhodes Scholar, has served as Attorney General and Governor of the state of Arkansas. Currently, he and his wife, Hillary Rodham, are living in Washington, D.C.'" He said, You never. As a matter of fact, when they introduce the president, all you do is you hear a voice off stage that says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." They don't even tell you his name, because that's it. Now, on the other hand, if the individual is not well known, you have to tell a little bit more about his background so that people have some idea about what he's speaking of. So, just simple rule: the better known, the less said. The less known, the more said. Well, as I tell you, I didn't know anything about that. And I arrived at the banquet that evening. I looked down, and there was this fellow, obviously very nervous. The green peas were just sitting on his plate, and the sherbet was melting. And he was mumbling what I thought didn't make any sense to me. I thought what he was mumbling: better known, less said, less known, more said. Finally, it came time for him to introduce me. Rather stiff-leggedly, he walked to the podium, looked out to the audience, and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure this evening to introduce to you the Chief Justice, and the less said about him, the better." Thank you, John. It was just perfect. If an alien from another planet visiting Earth happened to cross some of the current American publications or exposed to some of the current talk shows, the alien is likely to believe that the present legal system in America is teetering on the brink of disaster. For that matter, there are probably a number of Americans who also share that view. Judges and lawyers are blamed today for most of the ills of society, from increased crime to the heartbreak of psoriasis. In fact, In preparing these remarks for delivery today, I happened across just such a speech. The author in part maintained, and I quote, "Courts are distrusted, and executive boards and commissions with summary and plenary powers, freed so far as constitutions will permit from judicial review, have become the fashion." He went on to say, "It will be assumed then that there is more than the normal amount of dissatisfaction with the present-day administration of justice in America." End of quote. Actually, the address is not related to the present-day fad and ever-popular sport of court bashing, nor was it written by a disgruntled current citizen, but rather it is a speech delivered by Dean Roscoe Pound to the American Bar Association on August 29, 1906. The speech was entitled, "The Causes of Public Dissatisfaction with the Administration of Justice." It appears, therefore, necessary for us to recognize that the criticism of the legal system in America is not a new approach because of recent events, but rather has been a part of our system since the very beginning. Furthermore, the reason for so much open criticism may have not so much to do with the legal system as it does with the fact that in an open, democratic society, the public, thank goodness, is free to criticize and is not required to limit that criticism to the facts or the truth. Much of the objections voiced have nothing to do with the reality of the matter. Unfortunately, because the legal system generally, and courts particularly, are ill-equipped and untrained to counter the criticism, the unsupported statements feed upon themselves and gain credibility because the statements are frequently repeated. Yet few, if any, alternatives that can work are suggested. As an example, it's a popular slogan today to argue that there's too much litigation in America. Many maintain that we must reform our system in order to reduce litigation. While the evidence to support the statement that litigation is dramatically increasing in light of a growing adult population is highly questionable, nevertheless, even if the statement was true, I would not be greatly concerned. That's not because, as a lawyer, I wish to generate litigation for purposes of self-interest. Rather, it's because I recognize that litigation is the civilized way of resolving disputes, and that the alternative to that civilized method may be violence. Nor is the reason for whatever increase there is so difficult to understand. There are several reasons. Firstly, people today are much more involved in activities which give rise to disputes requiring resolution. One can hardly engage in any activity today for fun or profit that may not give rise to controversy. But that's not the fault of the law. That's simply a fact of life. I would suggest that lawyers do not cause automobile accidents. People with automobiles cause accidents, and there are many more people with automobiles. Lawyers do not cause contracts to be breached. People breach contracts, and there are many more people entering into contracts. And lawyers are not the reason persons become bankrupt. People's inability to pay their debts as they come due cause people to seek the benefits of bankruptcy. To blame the law and lawyers for these events would be like blaming hospitals and doctors for causing terminal illnesses. And just as eliminating doctors and hospitals will do little to reduce pain and suffering in the world, so too eliminating lawyers and courts will do little to reduce injury and disputes in the world. Lawyers and courts are not the cause, and eliminating lawyers and courts is not the solution. A second reason for whatever increase that exists is simply the fact that people today have a greater sense of wanting their rights and their day in court. We are not a passive society. To the contrary, we're an aggressive and assertive society. Does it seem so strange that if we teach our children to assert themselves, to speak for their rights, and to demand explanations, that when they reach adulthood, they should refuse to be passive and accept whatever is said to them? And if they refuse to accept, what alternatives are available except the courts in many cases. For many years, Japan has been held up as an example of a sophisticated society with few lawyers. It was indeed for many years. However, a fairly homogeneous society with little diversity and a culture that promoted passive behavior. Not so the modern Japan. While it still remains a fairly homogeneous society, it is certainly not the passive society it once was. I suggest that if one was to continue to follow the growth of the Japanese economy and its effect upon its society, it will see an expansion of its legal process and the use to which the public resorts to the courts. And finally, I believe a third reason why people have turned to the courts to resolve their dispute is because they believe they have nowhere else to turn. When I was growing up, people were hesitant to litigate. They turned to their priest, their minister, their rabbi to help resolve family and neighborhood problems. Not so today. The churches and synagogues are not utilized as they once were. Therefore, a void was created which needed to be filled by the secular law. Alternative methods of resolving disputes may be available. We need to continue examining that effect. The work which has been done to date, and a great deal has been done, is inconclusive. Nevertheless, we are seeking alternative methods to resolve disputes, and the public should be made aware of their efforts. But people have to understand that as these disputes arise, that there's got to be a method in place with which we have confidence and which we turn to quietly and effectively resolve these disputes. Let me now turn to another related issue, which is also greatly misunderstood in my view. While I do not wish today to engage in a debate regarding the merits of tort reform, I do wish to raise some issues that are related to that. There's a great deal of discussion today on the need for tort reform because of what is described as a system which is out of control. I'm not prepared today to debate that issue. And in fact, I believe that in the area of punitive damages, reform is required. Nebraska doesn't permit punitive damages, and I know of relatively few people in Nebraska who are taken advantage of by reason of that fact. But I find it significant and important that during all of the debate, there's no discussion about what to do with the wrongs which give rise to those lawsuits. There appears to be some general notion that if individuals have less opportunity to get to court, or if once they are limited in their recovery, there will be less need to get to court. I know of no basis for that conclusion. No matter what the law is or will be, accidents will continue to occur in America. Limiting the amount of recovery or the right of lawyers to charge a contingent fee will not prevent an accident from happening. Individuals will still be harmed, though perhaps without the ability to recover. And so the public needs to be informed early on that tort reform will not reduce injury, only the right to recover for injury. Persons who are rendered paraplegic may be limited in their right of recovery, but will not be limited in their need for care and treatment. And if they are unable to provide for the care themselves, then each of us, acting through the state, will be called upon to fill that gap, as opposed to the party who caused the injury. I have no quarrel with what system we may ultimately go to, so long as we understand that it's not the legal system which causes the injury in the first instance and will not be the legal system which will continue to cause injuries after reform. Moreover, large verdicts are blamed on clever lawyers. Yet it is a jury of 12 ordinary citizens who return the verdict or could withhold the verdict as they, in their sole absolute discretion, choose. There are people just like all of us in this room who render these outrageous verdicts. I find it interesting that in all of the discussion concerning the present crisis, no mention is made of attempting to produce safer products, developing safer surroundings, or attempting to make persons more sensitive to the rights and needs of others. As a matter of fact, we seem committed to discuss tort reform and a lessening of health and safety regulations all at the same time, without much discussion as to how the passage of both may impact the public. And yet we know that without some incentives, these necessary changes, which will reduce injury or harm, may never come about. One need only look back at the rivers and lakes of America before the Clean Water Act to understand that fact. The public has a right to have such a society in which recovery is limited, so long as they understand that it is their rights which are being affected. Yet in a recent survey, while people indicated they favored tort reform, when asked how they felt about it if they were the injured party, they took a completely opposite stance. We can't have it both ways, and lawyers have nothing to do with that decision. Telling it like it is may not be popular, but it is necessary. Some of you are familiar with the Greek play Antigones. There's a scene in the play, you may recall, in which two guards happen across the dead body of King Creon's son. They're reluctant to tell the king, and for some 10 minutes debate whether they should advise the monarch of his son's death. And if so, who should do it? One may wonder why they should be so reluctant, sad as the news may be, to carry the message to the king. The answer, of course, seems quite clear. They are afraid to carry the message because it is the practice in that time to kill the messenger. And yet it is clear to all who watch the play that whether the message is carried to the king or not, the son is dead. One may kill the messenger, but one cannot kill the message. Nor can the public continue to blame lawyers and judges because they are designated by our society to be the messengers. Furthermore, if the practice of killing the messenger continues, soon, like King Creon's guards, no one will want to be a messenger. Dean Pound, in his 1906 address, touched on another area which I believe causes a great deal of misunderstanding and confusion, and thus unfair criticism of the law. He said, and I quote, "A third perennial source of popular dissatisfaction with the administration of justice, according to law, may be found in the popular assumption that the administration of justice is an easy task to which anyone is competent. Laws may be compared to the formula of engineers," he said. "They sum up the experience of many courts with many cases and enable the magistrate to apply that experience subconsciously. So the formula enables the engineer to make use of the accumulated experience of past builders. Even though he could not work out a step in its evaluation by himself," Pound said, "a layman is no more competent to construct or to apply the one formula than the other. Each requires special knowledge and special preparation. Nonetheless, the notion that anyone is competent to adjudicate the intricate controversies of a modern community contributes to the unsatisfactory administration of justice in many parts of the United States," end of quote. It's sort of the notion that nobody needs to go to law school, nobody needs to practice, nobody needs experience. Everybody understands the law. Everybody ought to be able to resolve these matters easily enough. Anyone trained in the law is quick to recognize that knowing the answer doesn't solve the problem. The trick is to understand the question. Today I have most of the law on computer and can easily call it up with the touch of a finger. Knowing what the question is so that I may know what law to call up is what the controversy is all about. And that is simply not always easy to determine. A further and directly related area that appears to me to be at the root of the problem is a belief by the public that judges are free to make decisions in any manner they wish. When on the court, I was often asked, "What do I think about a particular matter?" And I was quick to reply that what I thought was of no moment. What I thought the law thought is what was significant. I was restricted, as I should have been, by the language of the Constitution, both federal and state, and by the statutes passed by the people through their representative bodies and by previous court decisions. that the people may not like the law as passed, that the legislative body may have been deficient in their passing of the law, is not a matter which I, as a judge, could or should correct. The public must understand that the role of the lawyer is to attempt to develop the facts often difficult to obtain, and the role of the judge or jury to decide the cases based upon the evidence presented at trial in light of existing law. And today, because of media coverage, because of television, there are often two trials going on at the same time. In the courtroom, there is a very regulated, sterile trial going on, heard by the jury. While in the hallways, on the steps, on the streets, there's this discussion of evidence that never gets to the finders of fact. And so we, who heard the evidence they didn't hear, and I put quotes around evidence because it wasn't subject to cross-examination, it wasn't subject to reliability, it wasn't subject to anything, wonder how could that dunderhead group of jurors do what they did when they didn't hear the same thing that we heard. The public must understand that this is just beyond the control of lawyers and judges, as it must be. There must be rules. Judges are often criticized for failing to follow the statutes as adopted by the legislature. Or they're often faulted for making legislation. Yet let them be a strict constructionist in an unpopular matter, and they're told to ignore the law and follow their common sense. The public must understand that the system is not without limitations, that like most other matters in life, the law, and therefore lawyers and judges and juries, are controlled and limited by predetermined rules which they are not free to ignore. And if the civil law causes us great concern, the criminal law drives us to the brink. I wish not to spend much of any time making any comment about the recent O.J. Simpson trial, partly because I did not watch much of it and therefore know little about it, and secondly because in the overall scheme of things, while it received a great deal of attention, it was a relatively small part of the criminal system which goes on every day in this country. Many would claim that reform must be brought about on the criminal side as well as the civil side, and would point to trials like Simpson. In fact, however, perhaps as many as 95% of all individuals formally charged with a crime plead guilty and are not subjected to trial. It is only a relatively few cases in the total scheme of things for which the trial is actually conducted. Or in any other way, the system would simply collapse. Another part of that is the concern about plea bargaining, for instance. People are always upset about the fact that prosecutors have plea bargained, and that doesn't seem to be appropriate. Let me share for instance, with you, and maybe you can see how important plea bargaining is to the system. Let's assume that one night, for reasons I need not explain to you, in a moment of anger, I come across your front lawn without your permission. I break into your house. With a gun in my hand, I come upstairs to your bedroom, hold the gun to your head, take from you all of your money, strike you violently across the face with my weapon causing injury, run downstairs to your garage, jump into your car without opening the front door, steal the car, drive it through the garage door, across the front lawn, knocking down the city light poles, traveling 48 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone until I am apprehended by the police. I have had what you might call an Excedrin headache kind of day. Now, in that event, I have committed at a minimum trespass, breaking and entering, burglary, robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, automobile theft, destruction of private property, destruction of public property, speeding. Were I to be charged with all of those crimes, found guilty and sentenced on each one of them, I would be sentenced to a minimum of 287 years in the penitentiary. And try as I will, I probably could not get more than 87 or 89 of those years served. Now, the prosecution then says, well, okay, what's likely to happen here? Judge is likely to sentence this individual to 30 years in prison. The penalty for armed robbery is not less than 5 nor more than 50. If I plea bargain for armed robbery and the individual comes in and pleads guilty to armed robbery, I have given the judge all of the latitude he or she needs to sentence the individual to the maximum sentence the judge is likely to sentence them to anyway. Why, therefore, clog the system, incur expenses, and try an individual on every single charge? And to support the protection of that, the judge is not bound to accept the plea. If they came in, for instance, with this individual charged only with speeding, the judge said, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to accept that plea. You may have forgotten, or maybe you never knew, of the most famous plea bargain denied in modern criminal history. In the Watergate case, Watergate came to light because the prosecutor brought the two who broke into the Democratic headquarters and plea bargained a trespassing charge. And Judge Sirica said, I'm not going to accept that. There's more to this case than what I see here. And I enter pleas of not guilty for both of you, and we're going to go to trial. So the judge isn't bound to do it. It's a system which is attempting to balance one against the other. Obviously, if we begin an examination of the criminal justice system by reaching a conclusion as to the guilt or innocence of the individual, the result of the case heard by the jury may be difficult to accept. But it was because we wish not to begin with a result that the system was designed by our founding fathers as it was. We had lived in Europe under a reign in which the accused was presumed guilty and either had the burden to prove his or her innocence or was so badly beaten until guilt was admitted, even though it may not have been true, that the chance to be fairly tried was nearly non-existent. We formulated the Constitution when we came to America in such a manner to create a presumption of innocence and to place upon the government a difficult burden of proof, not because we wish to be sympathetic to the guilty, but because we wish to protect the innocent. While at the court, I was often urged by members of the public to reconsider how the system was applied. I was urged not to extend constitutional rights to guilty people, or as some suggested, to permit guilty people to get off on technicalities. I was quick to point out to them that because of the presumption of innocence, an accused was never on and therefore never got off of anything. If one is presumed to be innocent and the government fails to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then the accused retains that presumption of innocence. And by the way, the technicalities which they refer to are known by another name: the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the various states. Furthermore, even if I was willing to ignore the Constitution on the argument that obviously the founding fathers of the Constitution never intended to extend the benefits of the Constitution to the guilty, but rather intended only for the protection of the innocent, I'd still have one minor problem. I had to figure out how to decide in advance who was guilty and who was innocent, so I would know to whom I would apply the Constitution and to whom I would not. And then I was back to square one. It's not so uncommon today to read of individuals who have been incarcerated for 8 or 10 or 20 years only to be released after it's determined that indeed they were wrongfully convicted. How more frequent that might occur if the system was less diligent and less protective of the accused. Now, I have to tell you that if I can be assured that neither myself nor any of my loved ones will ever fall into a trap of being wrongly accused, I guess I could be in support of doing away with all of this. But you just never know for sure when you might not be a part of the majority. Another solution which is frequently raised from time to time is the need to return to the popular election of judges. And this is one that I have campaigned against long before I went to the court. I practiced law in Nebraska when we had elected judges. I first started as a lawyer. I practiced law in Texas where they still have elected judges, and where periodically you sit in your office and the judges rotate through them and you write out checks for their campaign. Those who support the view on popular election of judges insist that only in this way can judges be responsive to the will of the people. In that very notion, however, we lose sight of what the role of the judge is to be. A judge is not intended to be responsive to the will of the people. The judge is to be responsive to the requirements of the law. Let me share with you another what if and see how that works out to perhaps better explain all of it. Let's assume that the legislature is in a session and they're about to pass a law with which you object. You get together with a group of your friends, you take a bus and you come down to Lincoln and you meet with that senator. You say, "Senator, I'm opposed to this bill. We don't care whether it's right or wrong. We don't care whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional. We're just opposed to this bill. And if you vote in favor of this bill, we'll oppose you. We'll tell everybody what you did. We'll campaign against you. We'll hold funds from you. We'll keep you from getting reelected." Well, the senator counts noses and decides that neither you nor your friends really represent a majority in his district, so he doesn't care, and he votes for the bill, and the bill is passed. Now the bill is sent over to the governor. Well, you and your friends get back on the bus again. You come down to Lincoln. You meet with the governor before he signs the bill. You say, "Governor, we don't care whether this bill is right or wrong, constitutional or unconstitutional. We're opposed to this bill. And if you sign this bill into law, if you don't veto this, we're going to tell everybody what you did. We're going to campaign against you when you run for re-election or higher office. We're going to withhold funds from you. We're going to punish you for not listening to us." The governor makes a count, and he decides that you and your friends don't represent a majority of the people in his state. He doesn't care. He signs it into law. Now somebody brings a lawsuit to challenge the constitutionality. Well, you're not going to be stopped by that. After all, judges are popularly elected. So you and your friends get on the bus and come down to Lincoln again to see the Chief Justice in chambers the day before the argument. After all, you've elected him. He has a need to listen to you. You say to him, "Your Honor," the other side's not present, of course, "Your Honor, we don't care whether this is constitutional or unconstitutional. We just are opposed to it, and we want you to find it unconstitutional. And if you don't find it unconstitutional, the next time you run for judge, we're going to tell everybody what you did. We're going to campaign against you. We're going to hold funds from you. We're going to get you out of office." Now, the Chief Justice is a better politician than both the senator or the governor. He realizes, by golly, you and your friends are powerful. And he makes that commitment. He says, "Don't worry. Tomorrow when I hear the argument, because I'm an elected judge and I'm responsive to the will of the people, tomorrow when I hear that argument, you have my commitment. I will find it unconstitutional. And, of course, I expect that when I run for re-election, you will support me and you will raise funds for me and you will remember what a great job I did for you." Now, when you think about that, it becomes ludicrous to talk about responsive to the will of the people. Legislators should be popularly elected. They have a constituency. A governor should be popularly elected. He or she has a constituency. Judges are precluded by law from having constituencies. They are to be independent. It simply cannot make sense, in my view, to talk about electing judges. Eliminate the right of a judge to be independent and to decide cases based upon the law, and you significantly affect the power of freedom. Judges who are cowered into making decisions because they are popular, though legally incorrect, erode the very foundation upon which our freedom sits. As former United States Supreme Court Justice Owen Roberts said, "When a person goes on the court, he or she ought not to have to defend upon the strength of his or her own character to resist the temptation to shade a sentence in an opinion or shade of view. He or she should not have to put an umbrella up in case it should rain. Rather, the judge ought to be free to say what he or she wishes to say, knowing, as the Founding Fathers meant the judge should know, that nothing could reach the judge and that his or her conscience was as free as could be. And finally, in my view, the public must understand that the law is not a science. It's an art. Honest people looking at the same facts can honestly reach different conclusions, because most often the differences are slight, not significant. That's what causes controversies and disputes. It's not the easy, clear matters which generally cause litigation, but the thorny, close questions with which lawyers and judges are asked to deal. It's further popular these days to bemoan the role that lawyers play in society, both in and out of courts. It's suggested by some that life would be so much more pleasant and simple without lawyers. Rather than finding fault with us, rather than attempting to lay all of society's fault at our doorstep, I believe it's important that people begin to understand that it is lawyers and courts which, in part, make America different and unique. Lawyers and judges are often reminded of Shakespeare's lines from Henry VI, in which it's declared, "And the first thing we will do is kill all the lawyers," and then there's laughter. That line may bring glee from the public, but it's important to remember the scene in which the lines are spoken. The parties are plotting to overthrow the government and put an end to freedom. They're quick to recognize that unless they rid the country of lawyers, they cannot rid the country of freedom and democracy. Those who advocate the elimination of lawyers and judges offer no alternatives. Somehow they mistakenly believe that by simply eliminating our numbers, they resolve their problems. When asked how they propose to resolve their disputes with each other, they're unable to tell you. When asked how they are to be made aware of when they've been wronged, they're unable to tell you. When asked how to propose to guarantee their rights when government seeks to oppress them, they're unable to tell you. These facts must be called to their attention, and it must be done now. As we meet to discuss changes in our system, we should reflect for a moment upon what prompted our forefathers to leave their homes and face the dangers of the new world. It was to free themselves of arbitrary rule and to secure for themselves and their posterity inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, ideals which can only exist in a society ruled by laws and not by people. Does it not seem strange that Fidel Castro doesn't have a great problem of people swimming ashore? Just hardly ever has to worry about that at all. One need only look at the world over, at those countries in which human and civil rights are not afforded to individuals, and one will find that there's a direct relationship between the absence of that freedom and the right of the people to be represented in a court of law presided over by an impartial judge. It's not the mere presence of a document entitled Constitution that guarantees freedom and rights to individuals. Publics must understand for their own good that all countries, free and oppressed, have legal systems. That's the first thing they do. I mean, during all of the Soviet Union's oppression, they had a Supreme Court, and they had judges, and they had lawyers, and they had Siberia. The difference is that some are in form and some are in substance. All of this is not to say that the system doesn't need improvement and modification. Like all institutions, it requires constant care and maintenance. That's not the same as a complete overhaul. Neither do I suggest that every person can or should agree with every decision rendered by every court. The reason that the matter has been presented to the court is because a controversy exists. Obviously, the party who does not prevail is not likely to agree with the result or think the judge or jury very bright. Moreover, courts are more and more being asked to resolve disputes generating high public emotional feelings, matters which really have to do with your own view of society with regard to morals, with regard to religion, that courts are ill-equipped to try and resolve. There is no way for a court to resolve a highly emotional case without being subjected to criticism. And yet, the public must understand that the court is the messenger and not the message. I would suggest that the public criticism of the court system in America is not evidence of the system's failure, but rather of its success. It's only because the system works as well as it does, considering the numbers involved, that persons have time to criticize isolated decisions. The defects, if indeed they exist at all, based upon the total numbers considered, is in the third or fourth decimal place. I know of no other enterprise that's asked to meet that stringent a standard. The question should not be whether everyone agrees with the result, but rather was it reached honestly, fairly, and without the intervention of improper consideration. And that should be the test by which the system is measured. If that test is applied, I believe the system will receive high marks. In conclusion, let me answer the title of my address this morning, The Cause of Popular Dissatisfaction with the Administration of Justice Revisited. I believe it is due to a combination of things. One, the complexity of the problem brought, and two, a desire by us for quick, simple solutions supporting our predetermined view of how the case should be concluded. That cannot always occur. Someone will usually be disappointed. That disappointment should not be the basis for measuring the system. Rather, we should continue to examine and modify the system in light of its history and the needs of a free society. It may very well be that because we have enjoyed our freedom for so long, we take it for granted. History does not support such a view. Freedom is not easy to come by and requires high fences to keep out those who would oppress us. Each of us must take our turn at maintaining the fences by supporting our systems and fairly analyzing its problems. Only in that way can we continue to express our dissatisfaction with the administration of justice, a right granted only to the free who are protected by a fair legal system supported by independent judges. As you can undoubtedly tell, I'm rather fond of the law. I'm proud to be a lawyer. My children are lawyers, and I'm proud of that fact. And God willing, I hope my grandchildren will be lawyers. We do much to protect the freedom of society, and with your understanding, your assistance, and with the help of some of you here in this room who will join our ranks, we will continue to keep America free. Thank you very, very much.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Norman Krivosha, former Chief Justice of the State of Nebraska. His lecture was entitled, The Popular Dissatisfaction with the Judicial System Revisited. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.